Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, March the 9th, 2016, 12:14 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, coming up on 12:15. Scott Spears along with you today on the Now program. And I don't want you to leave your radios for the next 2 hours because we have got a great program. Coming up in hour number two today at 1:10 p.m. this afternoon, we're going to be joined by legendary actor, commentator, former newsman from 60 Minutes, Charles Grodin, who will be on to discuss the election and a whole lot of other things going on in the world of current events. Charles Grodin coming up today at 1:10 p.m. Eastern Time. And at the bottom of this hour, coming up at a quarter till 1, we're going to be joined by the Lieutenant Governor of the state of Ohio, the lady running things right now while Governor Kasich is out running for president. Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor will be on with us in the last 15 minutes of this hour to discuss everything that went on last night in Michigan and Mississippi and what's going on with Trump and the entire Republican race, that coming up in the bottom of this hour. Now, for the first 30 minutes of this hour, we're going to remember First Lady Nancy Reagan, who sadly passed away on Sunday at the age of 94. Funeral plans now will be this coming Friday, March the 11th, at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific, but 2 p.m. here in the East. I believe that'll be covered on CNN. Today we're going to talk with a man who has a very unique perspective on the Reagan way of life in the presidency and a little bit out of the presidency. He was Ronald Reagan's personal biographer, spent a lot of time with him, and wrote a great book a few years ago now, but it's still a great book, and if you haven't read it or are a fan or just have an interest in history of Ronald Reagan, pick it up. The book is Dutch. I'm sure you can find it. The author, historian Edmund Morris. So glad to have him on today. Edmund, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
You know, Edmund, I kind of want to start back here before we get into Nancy. Tell me how you met Ronald Reagan. How did you end up becoming his biographer?
It's a fairly long story, but I'll try and keep it short. When he became president and when he was elected in 1980, he started reading biographies of his predecessors, as many presidents do. They're curious about the few people who've held that job. And one of the books he read was my biography of Theodore Roosevelt, which he seemed to enjoy. And as a result, after he was elected, my wife and I were invited to the White House to a state dinner in August of 1981, and that's when I met him for the first time.
When you first met Ronald Reagan, what were your impressions?
I underestimated him. I thought he was a large, attractive, not very interesting person. I thought he was cornball and came from the wrong side of the country, the usual snobbish things that intellectual New Yorkers think and say. So when it became clear to me that he would be willing for me to write his biography, this was an idea circulated by people around him, including the Library of Congress. They thought it would be a neat idea if I, the biographer of Theodore Roosevelt, became the biographer of Ronald Reagan and actually be in the White House to see him operate. When this idea was suggested to me, I, as I say, underestimated him and did not think I wanted to do it because I thought Reagan was rather dull. And after a couple of years had passed, I began to realize how seriously I had underestimated him. In the year 1983, his presidency was confronting enormous issues, both home and abroad, and he was dealing with them splendidly. So I began to regret having this disparaging attitude and began to want very much to write about him.
You know, Edmund, President Reagan now is thought of almost in mythical terms. Every debate he's brought up, he's thought of as the hallmark of the kind of the gold standard of Republican presidents. When he was in office, Is he really that person to you? Is he the hallmark of all Republican presidents?
No, I think the myth is ridiculous and grotesque. He was, in my opinion, the most important president we've had since World War II, in the sense that he brought about the greatest changes in America's national standing of any president, at least since the time of Harry Truman. So although I admire him greatly as a president and think he is of historic value, the sentimental legend that's grown up about him is really quite ridiculous.
He's
a human being, and he had many distressing personal qualities which in no way affected his performance as president.
Why do you think he has taken on this mythical attitude? Why are the other Republican presidents, why haven't they been able to eclipse him?
Well, one of the reasons they mythologize him, of course, is the fact that he was so successful. Young Ron Reagan, his son, whom I'm very fond of, once said to me, you know, my father has had like 7, if not 9, different lives, different careers during the course of his life. And he said, in every one of these careers, he has succeeded. He was a successful sportscaster, successful film star. One of the things I discovered in researching Dutch was that he was the number one box office attraction in Hollywood in 1942. People forget that. He was subsequently a successful trade union leader, a successful businessman, corporate spokesman, then a successful governor, and a successful president. And young Ron said to me, if you can be successful in so many fields, you cannot, you've got to admit the fact that he was something quite phenomenal.
But you do say the man did have his flaws. What are some of the things you noticed that we certainly don't talk about now when it comes to Ronald Reagan?
Well, the fact that he wasn't interested, remotely interested, in any other person in the world. He had no personal curiosity about people. Not even about his own children. Sometimes his daughter Patty got the creepy feeling he didn't know which child she was. And there's a famous example of Michael, his son, graduating from Loyola College in Los Angeles when his father, who was then governor of California, handed him his diploma and said to him, "Good luck, young man." And Michael looked at him and said, "Dad, it's me, Michael, your son." So this impersonality I'm talking about, the fact that he didn't know who anybody was and didn't much care, it's very distressing to those who rather hoped that he would notice who they were and admire them. Reagan was interested in people en masse. He liked large audiences. He was uncomfortable in one-on-one intimacy. He was basically a shy person.
When you were with him, because he is thought of in mythical terms now, and not many people around today certainly had the relationship that you had with him, or at least being able to be that close to him. When you were with him, did you look forward to being with him?
Oh, yes, he was enchanting. I've got to emphasize that although he was a cool personage, and as I say, not particularly interested in other human beings as individuals, he had the most irresistible personal charm. And I not only basked in it myself, I would observe how everybody who came into his orbit basked in it like seals basking in the sun. He discharged an extraordinary personal sweetness and positivity and optimism. And I think this is the reason we look back on him with such affection.
Do you believe that was the actor or just a skilled politician?
A lot of it was the actor. I don't think there's much difference between Reagan's abilities as an actor and his skill as a politician. They were more or less two halves of the same appeal. When, as a student of 17, 18 years old, he made his first political speech at college, he said that the sound of the applause when he made the speech was like wine in his blood. So theater and politics were intertwined in his personality right from the start.
How many years, what was your relationship like with him over the time you were with him, and how many years were you with him?
I came on board as his biographer in the spring of 1985. And I stayed with him, interviewing him, following him around, more or less frequently, up until his announcement to the American people in 1994 that he had Alzheimer's and was going to retire from public life.
I know that, I'm sure you're aware, I'm not sure if you've read it or not, that Bill O'Reilly published his book, Killing Reagan, in which he makes some interesting assertions that President Reagan was almost removed from office not too long after being shot, that he would watch soap operas during the day, sometimes not come down at all and deal with anything, that the Alzheimer's was present to some degree, not to a great degree, during his presidency. What's your feeling on that?
Well, some of that's true and some of that is nonsense. It's perfectly true that at the climax of the Iran-Contra affair in 1986, Reagan was so distressed by the situation that he began to, his detachment and his confusion began to worry his staff, and the close aides who worked for his chief of staff, Don Regan, put it out that the president was losing it. When the new chief of staff came in, Senator Howard Baker, with a new group of aides, they took this worry so seriously that they actually arranged to have their initial meeting with the president and observe him very closely to see if, in fact, he was losing capacity to be an effective leader, in which case they would have tried to invoke the Constitution to have the vice president take over. But as soon as Reagan appeared at that meeting and performed with his usual authority and clarity, they realized it was by no means true, that he was merely somebody who had been temporarily distressed by the mess that his presidency got into and didn't quite know how to get out of it. So that part of Bill O'Reilly's story is true, but to imply that he had Alzheimer's in the White House is absolute nonsense. And I can cite as a perfect proof of that the fact that dementia shows itself in bizarre processes, particularly the handling of language. Now, I've read every word of his handwritten diaries, which he kept every night in the White House for 8 years. And the sentence structure and the clarity, sequential coherence of those diary entries is exactly the same all the way through, right through to the end. He was a clear-thinking man in the White House. He did get old, he did get tired at times, but dementia did not afflict him until long after he left the White House, and it came upon him very suddenly in the early part of 1993.
When did you first notice it, and was there any trigger, or was it just something that came on?
What I did notice, and this would have been about 2 years after he left the White House, was a growing remoteness about him, which I've seen in other patients suffering from Alzheimer's. They seem to gradually retreat from you, step by step, into a position of disappearance. Anyway, I noticed he was becoming remote and rather strange in 1992, but it wasn't until his birthday celebration in 1993 at Simi Valley, at the Reagan Library, at a ceremonial dinner at which the guest of honor was Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of Britain. He got up and made a speech in honor of his guest, Margaret Thatcher. And he spoke slowly, but with his normal beautiful voice, saying, "In 1981, when I was elected President of the United States, there was only one leader of the Western world who stood with me as a bulwark against the threat of international communism, my good friend Maggie Thatcher." And he gestured toward her, so we all stood up and gave her a standing ovation. And then Reagan says, "In 1981, when I was president," and he went through this exact same speech again, exactly the same gesture. And the whole room froze because we all realized something bizarre was going on.
You know,
that was the beginning of it.
It's very interesting because they always talk about how guarded Nancy Reagan was, how protective she was. It's interesting, her being with him, I assume, a lot of the time, that she didn't notice something like that or think something like that might happen. I remember that speech. That speech is televised. That was a very bizarre moment. Do you think she might have been in some kind of denial?
Oh, no, but naturally, being so protective as she was, she must have seen this coming on earlier than any of us. She must have realized he was becoming strange. And she was so fiercely protective and fiercely private that she kept it a secret as long as she could. But when it got to the point that it had to be announced publicly, because a news story was about to come out in one of the California newspapers, that's when his staff and Nancy persuaded him to write a formal letter telling the American people that he'd got Alzheimer's and make his formal farewell.
You write in the book very poignantly about a conversation you had with Nancy Reagan after the White House, dealing with the Alzheimer's, where you ask how the president is, and see a whole different side of Nancy Reagan.
Well, you mean where she broke down, confessing how desperate she was?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Nancy was, she was the, although I say she was private and protective, when you talk to her personally, one-on-one, she could be beguilingly frank, and she was a woman at that point going through the torments of losing somebody she adored to this terrible disease. So she frankly and touchingly confessed to me that she just didn't know how to handle it.
When you were following Reagan around and having meetings with him in the White House, the narrative that has come out this past week, and it's been there before, was that Nancy ran the show at the White House, that she made personnel decisions, that she would whisper things to President Reagan. How much of a force was Nancy Reagan?
There's less there than meets the eye, although you're right in saying that she was influential in personnel matters. And I'm glad she was, because one of Reagan's weaknesses was he was such a nice guy that he thought everybody else was a nice guy, and he tended to like everybody and trust everybody. And when you're president of the United States, you're constantly being approached by predatory people, people who want to take advantage of you. So Nancy understood earlier on that she was going to have to protect him in that sense, in exactly the way, by the way, that Edith Roosevelt protected Theodore Roosevelt, who had the same problem of trusting and liking everybody. She, on the contrary, mistrusted everybody. She was very street smart and very pathologically cautious. So she vetted every personnel appointment and made sure that nobody ever took advantage of her husband.
There are two perceptions of Nancy Reagan for anybody who lived through the Reagan administration. When she was in there, she was called the Dragon Lady. Don Regan wrote this book describing how difficult she could be and how much in charge she was. But then after office, she wrote a book Some people called it the Getting Even book. And in later years, taking care of the president for 10 years through Alzheimer's and her work for stem cell crossing party lines to do that, she became really a beloved figure, I think, by most people. Which one is the real Nancy Reagan?
I think the former is the real one. Nancy was a tough little lady, street smart and a street fighter. She had a traumatic childhood, and she never forgot that. It left her with lifelong insecurity. The one person that she dedicated her life to and whom she loved with a passion was Ronald Reagan. And she loved him with such exclusivity that her children all felt deprived. I think it's kind of significant in view of all the sentimental things that are being said about her these days, that not one of her four children cared for her at all. Patty Davis, her natural daughter, wrote a devastating book about her in the 1990s, about being brought up with this fierce, cold mother who was quite happy to beat her physically in public and would come in and stare at her while she sat on the toilet just to make sure that her teenage daughter wasn't taking drugs. So the family story is pretty nightmarish, I can assure you, as the books written by her children have testified. So one doesn't like to speak ill of the dead, but on the other hand, I'm a biographer, and I have to acknowledge that Ronald Reagan was married to a woman who was, in many aspects of life, pretty well much of a monster. So the Dragon Lady epithet is not unjustified.
It's very interesting because as a biographer, I think you're right. You do have to tell the truth. You were given a lot of access to President Reagan. Dutch came out originally in 1999 and was praised by a lot of people, but somebody who was not very happy was Nancy Reagan.
Well, of course not. I sent her the first copy the day before publication saying, "Nancy, here it is. You're not going to like it because I'm a biographer, I tell the truth, and I've represented your husband, I think, fairly, and I've documented everything I've said. And I've given equal space to your predecessor." This was a very sore point with Nancy. She hated the idea that Reagan had been married before. So I said, I think the book will probably distress you, but I hope that as the years go by, you'll look at it in a fairer light and realize that actually, the totality of the book shows that Ronald Reagan was a great president. But I never expected to hear from her again, and I did not.
When you were writing the book, because you do have to be honest, as you said, did you know you were writing a book? Because at that point, President Reagan was probably, by all accounts, in 1999, no longer reading books 5 years into Alzheimer's disease. Were you worried that it was going to tick his family off, at least Nancy?
Oh, no, not at all. One cannot be like that. If one is an honest writer, one does not have to, calculate the effect of the book on people. The story is the story. However, since you asked about his family, three of his four children, Ron, Patty, and Michael, all published eloquent defenses of the book after it came out, because the book did cause a lot of controversy, as you remember. But Ron and Patty and Michael all said that they learned things about their father from that book that they were completely unaware of, and they could not have been more supportive of what I wrote. The only one who criticized the book was his eldest daughter, Maureen, who said it was a disservice to her father's memory, and she would not read one word of it.
When do you think the relationship... Was it when the book came out, when the relationship turned sour with Nancy?
Relationship between whom?
You and Nancy, yeah.
I don't think it I had no knowledge that it turned sour. I'm sure the book upset her. There's passages in the book, for example, which draw a list of the uncanny resemblances between her and Jane Wyman, his first wife. It's really quite creepy. I could read you some of them if you want, but no second wife can read something like that without getting really disturbed.
It's interesting because in the remembrances we've done of Nancy this past week, we've had on Douglas Brinkley, who went on to do the Reagan Diaries, which you talked about that you had read. And he didn't say a whole lot about it, but he said when he approached Nancy about doing this, that he had been forewarned that she felt that she had been burned in the past and your name came up. And it was hard for him to gain her trust to do that book.
Oh, I'm not surprised. It's very hard for anyone to gain her trust. I have to give her full credit for trusting me implicitly right from the start. Never once in all the years I was writing about Reagan and researching him and interviewing members of his family and his friends, never once did she try to stop me doing what I was doing, nor did she ever ask to have approval of the manuscript. So I owe Nancy a lot, and I have to say I got on very well with her. She was good company, much better company than he was. She loved gossip. She was interested in other subjects than politics, and I got on very well with her indeed. But I did know that as soon as I published the book, our relationship would come to an end.
As a biographer, looking at First Ladies, where does Nancy Reagan rank?
I'm not an expert on First Ladies. In fact, the only other one I know a lot about is Edith Roosevelt, because my wife wrote a biography of her. But from what little I know, I would say that she was personally essential to Ronald Reagan. Whenever she was not with him, he floundered and seemed desperately lonely. His need for her services was great. She did all the dirty work in that marriage. She had to bring up the children, she had to handle the finances, deal with gardeners and staff and all the boring details of life that Reagan eschewed. She protected him, as I've already said, from predatory people, and he knew that, so he relied on her. And his love for her was entirely expressed in terms of need. Her love for him was unselfish and total, and I think was a more genuine love than his for her.
That's perfect. So is the love story a little bit manufactured?
Oh, no. Love is complex. I would just say that whenever Nancy was away from the White House, I noticed in Reagan's diaries, all he would say was, "Oh, I'm missing Nancy so much. I wish she was here. I'm lonely." It never occurred to him, for example, when her own mother died in Arizona, she was desperately distressed by that, and she was in Arizona handling the funeral arrangements. He never once expressed any sympathy for her, any awareness of the fact that she was suffering. All he could say was, "Why isn't she back here with me?"
Being that you've said he was kind of distant, by the time your relationship ended, when you went in and visited him the last times when he was certainly in the grips of Alzheimer's, by that time, would you say he was a friend? Is he somebody you would call?
A friend? No. I don't think Ronald Reagan ever had a friend. All his male friends were buddies, barbecue buddies. And this distance that I talked about that surrounded him like a cocoon prevented real friendship.
When he died in 2004, were you shocked at the outpouring? That was really something.
I was not shocked. He was a great president, and as I say, a lovable person. All his basic instincts and desires were good. He wanted the best for his country. He believed in the dignity of the United States. He personified it. His nature was positive. And his achievements were concrete. So I think he's somebody who is very much worth the admiration of posterity. And I think the outpouring of grief when he died was entirely justified.
Do you... So in the end, even though you wrote a book that made his wife unhappy, do you like him? Do you think that the book promotes the legacy?
Well, that's two different questions. I've never had any emotional feelings for any of my subjects. I've written about Theodore Roosevelt, Beethoven, Reagan, and now I'm writing about Thomas Edison. I think it's necessary for a writer to be coldly objective about his subject and not fall in love or not fall in hatred. So in that sense, I can't say that I liked him, I can't say that I disliked him. But I do think that Dutch, the book I wrote about him, which although it was it caused a lot of distress at the time, also caused a lot of admiration. Time and time again, if not hundreds of times, I've heard from the sort of people who would never have voted for Reagan under any circumstances, that after reading Dutch, they had to accept the fact that he was a substantial person and a much more interesting and complex personality than they'd ever understood.
You know, Edmund, as I told you last night on the phone, I just, this book, when it came out, I was absolutely fascinated with it. I'm still fascinated with it to this day. We didn't nearly get into enough here, and I hope you do come back to discuss this more, because there's so much more in this book. We're just on limited time today, so I hope we can talk again soon.
All right, Scott, it's a great pleasure talking to you.
Hey, thank you. Edmund Morris, author of Dutch, A Memoir of Ronald Reagan. Be back after this short break with Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor. Everybody's talking about now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the Tomb of King Tut, there's a chuck full of nuts and McDonald's. At the Scala, they sing by a big Burger King where the styrofoam boxes go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Taco Bell went and franchised the wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
The legendary actress and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
What would we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott? Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire. Do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. But well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me. Hey, Scott Spears back with you here on WWGH Radio. 48 minutes coming up on 49 minutes past the hour. We want to thank Edmund Morris for coming on for the first 45 minutes. He is the author of the book Dutch, A Memoir of President Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's personal biographer spent nearly 10 years with him, 1984 to 1994, to share his memories of Nancy Reagan. And don't forget, coming up next hour, 1:10, actor and commentator from 60 Minutes, Charles Grodin, coming up. But now we have a very special guest, and so glad she's carved out some time to talk with us about last night's primary. Lieutenant Governor of the State of Ohio, Mary Taylor. Lieutenant Governor, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing very well. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Want to get right into it. Our governor, Governor Kasich, finished third last night, a strong third, in Michigan. 23 states have either caucused or had primaries. He hasn't won one yet, but what's your read on that?
Well, I think if you look at last night's results and you look at where Governor Kasich was 2 weeks ago, he was dead last in the single polling in the single digits in Michigan. But what we've seen is that late breakers, so to speak, voters making the decision later are shifting towards Governor Kasich. And so I think that's, you know, we understood and knew that that was going to happen as Governor Kasich travels and gets into the states where gets into states where primaries are going to be more advantageous to his message. So you're coming to the Midwest, the North, coming to Ohio. Governor Kasich is gonna win big. He's gonna win next week in Ohio, and I think that that will help reset the message, so to speak, about who the right Republican candidate is to head into the November election and beat either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders.
CNN poll came out today. Right now it has Donald Trump at 41%, Governor Kasich at 35% in Ohio. We all know polls can be wrong, but is it strange that Donald Trump is polling well in Ohio right now?
Well, I think as Governor Kasich comes back to Ohio, and I've seen the calendar, there are a lot of campaign activities over the course of the next several days leading up to the Tuesday primary. Again, I think people are going to be reminded of who Governor Kasich is, his strong leadership, his experience, taking an $8 billion budget deficit in Ohio and turning it into a $2 billion surplus, cutting taxes by $5 billion, and, of course, over 400,000 jobs have been created in the private sector. And so Ohioans will get the chance to be reminded of that experience and the policy that's driven that change in Ohio, and I think the governor's going to fare very well when Ohioans are focused on who they're going to vote for come next Tuesday.
We certainly want to think positive, and let's say that Governor Kasich does get his first win in Ohio next week. We'll be more than 60% of the way there delegate-wise. There's really no way, unless things really change, for him to get to 1,200 at this point. Do you think we're going to have a brokered convention here in Ohio in late July?
You know, that's a great question. Of course, everybody has their own opinion. Do I know? I don't know. Do I think? I think at this point, depending on how things turn out next week in Ohio, and of course as we go forward, and does any candidate end up with the number of votes that they need to become the Republican nominee, we could go into the convention here in Cleveland in July, and maybe we have a contested convention where, again, I think we see democracy work, and the delegates that are there will stand up and express their opinion and vote. But I think at this point, I'm going to focus on next Tuesday and helping Governor Kasich win Ohio, which I think is going to change the narrative coming out of Ohio on March 16th, and then, of course, as we go forward.
Governor Kasich has made statements that if he does not win Ohio, that he would leave the race. Do you think that's a wise decision?
I think we should wait and see how the results turn out next Tuesday. I think it's pretty clear that Governor Kasich needs to win Ohio, just like Marco Rubio needs to win Florida. And, you know, I think we'll wait and see what those results look like. And then I'm sure, you know, I expect for him to win. I expect to be heading into March 16th with John Kasich strong. And I think the other thing we need to keep in mind as we go to the polls next Tuesday, and of course certainly want and need all of the support we can get here in Ohio. Right now, Governor Kasich, John Kasich, is the candidate, the Republican, who beats Hillary Clinton in 17 points in Ohio, and Bernie Sanders by 19 points. And, of course, you know, we, as Republicans, we have to win Ohio in order to win the presidency. So I think that not only do we need to look at who our Republican nominee will be coming out of Tuesday, but we also need to be focused on who's going to win in November and who can win in November.
About a month ago, Governor Kasich gave a quote to the Columbus Dispatch that said he really had no interest in being anybody's vice president. But now people are speculating that that could be a possibility for the reason you just stated, that the Republicans do have to carry Ohio. Do you think there could be a possibility of that?
At this point, we're focused on next Tuesday and focused on delivering a victory for John Kasich. And right now, he's still running to become the president of the United States. So that's what I'm going to focus on.
I understand. Your party in the last week, the Republican Party, has had a little bit of trouble with the front runner. The last presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, came out and says he absolutely will not vote for Trump if he gets the nomination. There have been some rough debates as of late. Do you support Donald Trump if he becomes the nominee?
I support John Kasich, and I still think John Kasich is going to be our nominee, and I also think he is the best candidate to lead our Republican Party, to bring Americans back together, to restore hope and to restore prosperity. So I'm going to stay focused on that, and then if the time comes that I need to start thinking a little differently, I'll think more about that then. But right now, I am focused on supporting John Kasich.
I certainly understand that. You know, I've gotten a lot of questions because Governor Kasich's been campaigning since late last summer. How do things work in the state while he's gone? How is the state being run?
Well, if you know Governor Kasich at all, you know that he's very hands-on. This administration continues to push forward policies to move our state in a positive direction. The MBR bills, two have been introduced, one focused on higher education and making it more accessible to Ohio students, continuing to look for reforms there that will make a difference in the lives of our kids every day. And, of course, on looking at developmental disabilities and how do we better provide services here in Ohio to those that are developmentally disabled. So Governor Kasich is hands-on and is very much still driving policy here in the state of Ohio, and I think you'll see this administration, as we have, just continue to push those policies to continue moving Ohio forward.
As you have said, you support Governor Kasich. Let's say he does win Ohio and he goes to a brokered convention and he does get the nomination, or he decides to be vice president. Whatever happens will happen, and he could not be governor of Ohio anymore. Ohio has not had a female governor. Is that something you aspire to?
Well, interestingly enough, we had a female governor for about a week. That was Nancy.
That's right. I forgot. You're right.
Yes, I know. Most people forget that we have not elected a woman governor, which I think is relevant and important. Look, I have known, based on the position that I serve as lieutenant governor, that since day one I needed to be prepared to step in if necessary. It's part of the responsibility of being lieutenant governor. I have been very actively and integrally involved in this administration and the things that we have done and accomplished to get our state back on track and moving forward for the last 5 years. So, I have known since the beginning that you never knew what was going to happen in the future. Nobody can predict it. So I'm prepared, and I think we've got a great team. Governor Kasich has a great team of people around him, driving policy, leading the administration, and we're going to continue to focus on that here for the next year for sure, until we know how November turns out and then what's going to happen after that.
One thing that has been reported, it was reported in the Columbus Free Press about 2 weeks ago, that $1 million has been spent on the campaign over the last almost year now of taxpayer dollars for John Kasich. Is that accurate?
I don't know, honestly. I haven't seen the numbers, so I don't want to speak to the accuracy.
If, just on this, as an Ohio citizen, as an Ohio voter, and the many who are listening right now, when that kind of money is spent for taxpayer dollars, I think we all support when the candidate's doing well, but when they're not the front runner, do you think that's hard for taxpayers to take?
Look, our governor is Governor John Kasich. He's our governor 24/7, and I think that what we do to protect and allow him to continue to serve is relevant and important, and I think that it's necessary, and I think that we need to keep that in mind as we move forward here.
Speaking to the voters of Ohio right now, why next week should they cast their vote for John Kasich?
John Kasich is the leader that has the experience. He is the only, I heard this fact last night, and it's true, the only candidate in this race that has balanced the budget in Congress and balanced a state budget, a budget here in the state of Ohio. He's had experience in working on the Armed Services Committee and understands that we need to cut out the fat and the bureaucracy and red tape in our Defense Department and get more resources to our men and women who are serving on the ground and protecting us every day. His policies have worked here in Ohio and gotten our state back on track, and I think he's proven that his formula works, not here only here in Ohio, but it's a formula that can work for the rest of our country as well.
As we part ways, I just want to throw an opinion question at you. Tomorrow night's the Republican debate on CNN at 8:30. There was much speculation going into Ohio, and because Governor Kasich did, he finished third, but it was a strong third in Michigan, that he might be the target for the first time of other candidates tomorrow night. What do you expect to happen tomorrow night?
Well, you know, I expect whether he's their direct target or not, John Kasich is gonna be in the debate. You'll see the same John Kasich that you've seen before. He is not going to get down in the mud and fling mud and call names. He's going to focus on his record of accomplishment and his vision for the country and how his policies have restored hope in Ohio and how those same policies can help restore hope in our country. And I would expect that he'll stay focused on that.
Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor has been the guest. Lieutenant Governor, I hope maybe we can speak with you next Wednesday, and maybe it'll be a celebratory time for your office and Governor Kasich's office.
Great. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor, we're going to break and come back on the other side with Charles Grodin, which is always fun. You won't want to miss that, folks. Stay tuned.
If I were a bitty, bitty rich, I did little, man. I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. I don't think any mom wants to pay me.